So, hello everyone. I'm very happy to be here with you. This is MIT, and I'm going to talk about War and Peace and Science for the People. I was here protesting with them against university complicity with the war machine. That was the language used in those days. I don't think young people use that language anymore, but so that's what MIT is still complicit with, the war machine, and you know, and the Koch brothers. And I want to make note of that. It's also September 11th, and I want to make note of that as well. And I hope in my remarks to show that whereas when 9/11 occurred 13 years ago, I did not think of climate and terrorism and counterterrorism in the same breath, in the same sentence. I think most of us saw these as separate phenomenon. I was a peace activist, not an environmentalist at that time. But since then, I believe, to use that word, convergence, there's been a convergence of peace, war and peace issues and climate. And that's what I want to talk about tonight, is that convergence. Now I think they're totally interlinked. So I do want to recognize the anniversary and try to show how in the future, our work on climate is as much a part of addressing the causes of violence as anything else. So I'm going to make three propositions tonight, and really what I want to do really is have a conversation with you all and get your feedback on these thoughts, because I think these are the central, what I believe are the central themes of what we all have to face. So I'll sketch out my view, but I'm very eager to hear what you have to say about them. So I have three propositions. Number one, climate change will make conflict more and more likely in the years ahead than it would be otherwise. That's the first. The second is that increased international friction and conflict will make it much harder to solve the climate problem. So the more conflict and friction and mistrust in the world, the harder it's going to be to solve climate change. And the third proposition I'll make is the only way to increase the prospects for both peace and climate progress is to promote international cooperation in the pursuit of sustainability and equitable resource consumption. So that's the outline of what I want to try to say. And now let me dig into this and then get your feedback and comments. So first, climate change will make war more likely. I'm absolutely convinced of this. Now, most conflicts, all conflicts, I would say, all conflicts are caused by some combination of resource competition, or greed, as it's sometimes called, but I prefer resource competition, and grievance, ethnic, religious differences and antagonisms. All war is some combination of them both. It's very hard to find any conflict that doesn't include those two in some proportion. Some cases, the resource competition or greed is the prevailing motive. States, governments fight for control over valuable raw materials for economic reasons or for what they perceive as national security, and or to enrich the rich and powerful who control the government. This is what drove the expansion of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was about plunder, pure and simple. And if you see the images from Roman sculpture and art, the returning troops from their great victories over all of the non-Roman peoples that surrounded them, you will see them carrying the wealth and the slaves, because slavery then was the most useful source of wealth for empires. And you see images of the Roman returning soldiers holding up the golden cups and slaves in chains and so on. This was the cause of the imperial wars, colonial wars of the 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th, 19th century, the wars that occurred in the Western Hemisphere and Africa. They were all about plunder and enslavement. More recently, the wars over oil in the Middle East, and just something that's come up this summer, the conflict in the South China Sea for control of undersea oil and natural gas. In these cases, resource predation, term I use, or plunder, is really the driving motive for war. In most cases, though, resource competition is intermixed with grievance, with historic resentments among groups, whether defined by race, by class, by ethnicity, religion, tribe, linguistics, language, whatever. People come to blows out of these historic antagonisms. And mostly nowadays, when you pick up the newspaper, listen to the news, you get the impression that all wars today are about grievance, about ethnic and religious grievances. But I would argue that in many cases, most cases, these grievances are actually a legacy of past resource predation and plunder. They represent a history in which one group seized the territory, land being the first and most important resource that people fought over, land on which you could grow food to survive. So people would, like the Romans, conquer land to produce food and to steal slaves for their own use. So one group conquering another group for their own greed. But the group that is defeated in these conflicts may scatter. They may be diasporas. The remnants of the defeated peoples are going to bear resentments that last for all time. And if you read the Hebrew Bible, you will see that a lot of the early chapters are of wars of conquest for land, water, in which the original peoples of various areas are driven out. They're abused, and a lot of the religious history that follows up to the present goes back to those ancient battles in which people were robbed of their freedom and their land. And this is behind a lot of the conflict between Israel and Palestine. The Israelis, of course, felt dispossessed by the Babylonians and the Ottomans. They feel they have a right to that land, but in the process, they dispossess the Palestinians. And those people feel intense resentment for what happened to them. Yes, it takes religious form. It's a division along religious lines. But I would argue these trace back to resource plunder and competition. We see this in what happened to the native peoples around the world. Indigenous peoples to this day are being driven off their land. Now there's a new wave of expansion to produce oil, natural gas, and coal and uranium in the last remaining areas inhabited by indigenous peoples in the Amazon and the Arctic and around the world. And these people are fighting back. And yes, these are ethnic battles, but they're really resource wars. Look at the Iranians. Why do they hate us so much? Is it because, we practice a different religion? Well, it's expressed that way. But if you look at the history, Iran was, the leadership in Iran was overthrown by the CIA in 1953, and the Shah was put in power. The Shah, with U.S. military aid and training, then suppressed the Shiite clergy and everybody else in the population, for that matter, using equipment stamped made in USA. a lot of the Shiite leaders were tortured and jailed in the Shah's prisons with U.S. Help. So it's hardly surprising that they bear resentment to the U.S. Why did the U.S. overthrow the government of Iran? Because its leader, Mohammad Mossadegh, had nationalized the oil companies and put them under Iranian ownership. And our leaders at that time considered that the worst crime imaginable, and he had to be overthrown. And the Shah put in power because he restored the oil companies back to British and American ownership until much later on. I don't mean to go on and on. This is what I do. This is what my research and teaching is about. So I like to talk about this. So much of the conflict we see and so many of the resentments are driven historically or in the present by competition for resources, by which I mean land, water, food, one's own body, gold, ivory, furs. This area was first settled first for furs and then later for timber, then for agricultural land, for the codfish. And it required ethnic cleansing of the people who inhabited this land we step on. It led to a brutal war of extermination in the 1670s, King Philip's War. So this goes on. Land, that was land and timber. Now it's more often oil or natural gas, uranium, coal, and valuable minerals. Now, these grievances, this competition would exist under any circumstances. And I believe in the 21st century, we're going to see more conflict over resources. I don't have time to lay out the whole argument. It has to do with globalization, the rise of middle classes around the world, the rise of China, population growth, urbanization. The demand for resources is increasingly exceeding the supply, and this is going to create stress, enormous stress. So that would be true even without climate change. But now add climate change, and climate change is going to increase all of this exponentially. Why? Because the effect of climate change, we tend, or at least environmentalists have expressed this as kind of a threat to the physical environment as its own sake, the degradation of the environment. But essentially what's going to happen is that water is going to disappear in many arid parts of the world, especially the tropical area and the semi-temperate areas like North Africa, the American Southwest, Central America, the Caribbean, Central Asia. These areas are already water scarce, food production is already under stress, and now we're going to see a substantial reduction in the supply of water in these areas at a time of rising population. So food production is going to be harder and harder. The most recent report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has horrific, and they're very conservative, horrific projections for the drop in crop yield in Africa, in India, in Central Asia, because of heat and drought. So what's going to happen? Hundreds of millions of people who can now support themselves are going to be forced to abandon their land and migrate to the cities, which are already crowded with previous migrations, where they're going to find hostility. Those who can are going to try to flee to Europe and the United States and China, where they will face immense hostility and violence. All of this is going to multiply. And states will increasingly be forced into a position where they have to fight with one another over scarce water supplies. India and China, for example, share some of the same water sources. And China wants to divert these rivers, the upstream of the Brahmaputra River, one of the most important rivers in India, the upstream of the Mekong River, diverted for Chinese use at the expense of downstream countries. And this will lead to intense friction, I fear. And if you've ever read, I encourage you to read Jared Diamond's book, Collapse. What is collapse about? The collapse of ancient civilizations is when the climate changes, food and water become more scarce, and people fight with one another for what's left. That's what we face today. So climate change will exacerbate all the divisions in society that already exist. It doesn't cause them. These ancient animosities have their own roots. But in places like the Jordan River Valley, the Nile River Valley, the Indus River Valley, people who are already clashing for historic reasons are now going to be faced with extreme water scarcity, and this will push them over the brink. That's the fear. That's the fear. And we see this already. In 2010, there was severe drought in Brazil, Argentina, Australia, and especially in Russia and Ukraine. As a result, the market supply of grain largely vanished, and what was available increased enormously in price. In the Middle East, in the North Africa, the price of bread doubled in the few months in November and December of 2010. And this is on top of unrest already there, hostility to the established governments, but it was the doubling of bread prices for poor people who have to spend most of their income on food that created the tinder, the anger that fed the Arab Spring. About the same time, the Euphrates River, which is contested between Iraq, Syria, and Turkey, was at its lowest level in decades, if not in recorded history, because of global drought. And a million people in Syria, farmers, were forced to migrate to the cities, where they were treated like dirt by the Assad regime. And that's where some of the earliest anger came from, was where they settled in the poorest cities of Syria, the uprising against the Syrian government. So we already see how climate change is fueling conflict around the world. And so the more that climate change advances, the more I believe you'll see competition for vital resources. This will divide along ethnic and religious lines in many areas of the world and spark conflict. Now, the second proposition that I said is that all this increased tension and conflict in the world is going to make it a lot harder to solve climate change. Now, I think we're going to the UN next week for a simple reason. We cannot solve climate change in this country. Not that we're exactly on the verge of solving it in this country. But even if we were to solve it in this country, if China proceeded on the path it's on today, and India proceeded on the same path, and Brazil and Turkey and the other rising countries of the developing world that want a lot more electricity very quickly and are turning to coal to provide that energy or other fossil fuels, it doesn't matter what we do in this country. We must have an international movement, an international collaboration to address climate change. There is no other way. It has to be international. And countries that disagree, that agree on nothing else. You cannot solve climate change unless you bring on board at the very least, USA, Western Europe, Russia, China, India, and Japan, because together they are responsible for, I'm making this number up, I could give you the exact number, it's 80 or 90%, 80% of greenhouse gases are from those places, mainly from the old industrial powers and the rising industrial powers. If they don't agree, then there is no hope for a international solution to climate change. So countries that are currently in bad terms with one another are going to have to sit down at the bargaining table together to solve this problem. The U.S. is going to have to work with Russia and China and India as well, and Japan and the EU are going to have to do that as well. There is no other way. So if we live in a world of greater friction and conflict where these countries are less and less inclined to trust each other and work with each other, the prospects for solving climate change go down the tube. This is not a technical problem. We know how to solve the climate problem if we put our minds to it. But it has to be international. It has to be collaborative. Everybody has to be on board. So this is a political problem, not a scientific or engineering problem. So in a world of increased tension and conflict, we'll make it much, much harder to get all of these parties to sit down together, to work together on a climate proposal. And especially, I put most emphasis on the U.S. and China, because together, the U.S. and China are responsible somewhere in the vicinity of a third or more, 40% of all greenhouse gases. So if we don't cooperate, nothing else will do the trick. We have to get the U.S. and China to cooperate. And what's happening? We're moving in the opposite direction. Tensions between the U.S. and China are increasing at this time. A lot of it has to do with resource competition in the Western Pacific that threatens American allies, Japan and the Philippines, and the U.S. Because it feels threatened in its imperial status as the dominant power in the Western Pacific, feels it has to push back against China. And this is making the Chinese leadership much less inclined to cooperate with the United States. You see how these issues come together. We must get over these divisions and cooperate. So the third proposition then is that a climate change movement and a peace movement now today have exactly the same goal. They are not separate spokes. They are have the same goal. If to reduce peace, I'm sorry, to improve the chances for peace, to reduce the prospects for conflict, we have to prevent climate change. If we don't do that, the world is going to be more brutal, more violent, more dangerous, for the reasons I've explained. I hope I've explained. So to enhance the chances for peace in the world, we have to become climate activists. But by the very same token, the climate movement has to recognize the importance of building bridges across the world to other communities, and to work and to promote international peace and collaboration, because you cannot solve climate change without that. So the climate change movement has the same need, the same objective that we in the peace movement have, to promote international cooperation in promoting responses to climate change. And this means collaborating on a whole range of programs and efforts that will reduce the consumption of fossil fuels, most importantly, and the burning of forests, secondly, but especially curbing the burning of fossil fuels. And this requires, as I say, U.S. and Chinese cooperation. So we have to understand that I think we in the peace movement, many of us in this room anyway, have a history of working internationally. I see Joe up there does a lot of work with people in Japan, the survivors of the Hiroshima bomb, to build bridges, international bridges for peace. We have some experience in that. That has to be the model for the climate movement. It must become an international movement, and most importantly, we have to build bridges with NGOs, climate activists, environmentalists in China, India, and Russia. So our historic work of building bridges to those countries on peace and disarmament issues, we have to do the same thing around climate, because without that, our efforts here alone are doomed. We have to fight coal in this country, but mind you that in response to the efforts to curb coal use in this country, the coal companies are shipping the coal that we're not burning to China for burning there. So for all the talk we hear from the White House about reduced carbon emissions from coal, that's all smoke, because it's going to be burned in China, where it will make products for our consumption here. So we have to work with Chinese activists who are suffering from the horrible effects of coal pollution. This has to be the essence of the climate movement, I believe, is the way the peace movement saw it historically, groups like the Pugwash community, to build bridges with scientists around the world. So the emphasis has to be on eliminating consumption of fossil fuels and increasing the production of food in developing areas on an equitable basis with less water. This is going to be the biggest challenge for peace in the 21st century, is water scarcity and the violence that it will produce if this is not addressed. And this is an equity issue, to make sure that the countries that share rivers like the Nile, the Jordan, the Tigris-Euphrates, the Indus, the Mekong, that all of the people on these rivers have equal access to what's going to be a diminishing supply of water. So they have to learn how to grow crops more efficiently. So that is another path for international cooperation, where we bring in the NGOs in the developing world, in the poor countries, to help them solve their food and water problems in an equitable fashion in the face of climate change to avert conflict. So that's the essence of my argument, these 3 points. That climate change will make conflict more likely, that conflict, an atmosphere of conflict will make it harder to solve the climate problem, and that to successfully address both the peace, war, peace environment, and the climate problem, we have to collaborate here at home across these various constituencies, but internationally we have to build partners. So I'll stop there, and I want to hear from you. You could please feel free to challenge anything that I said. I'd love to get feedback, including disagreements. We're all in this together. I'd like your suggestions and your feedback. Since I'm an author, too, I have a few copies of my book, The Race for What's Left, which is about the pursuit of the world's last resources.